As with Plato's cave, the shadow that is the chest radiograph is simply a projection of a human being's chest, my patient and her illness. So if I may borrow from my old Uzbekistani friend, Al-Khwarizmi, there is always an algorithm. The picture is, if you like, greater than the sum of its parts. It's telling me a story, but that story is complicated by code. One has to understand the code. So as radiologists, we work in two systems, the solar system here, we're third rock from the sun, but also this atom, the radium atom, which I thought worked very well as a metaphor for both diagnostic radiology and clinical oncology. And this picture of the atom was designed by a Japanese physicist called Hantaro Nagioka, and it's not to scale, but it's caught on. It's very much the impression of the atom that we have. In fact, the Rutherford said the atom is actually a cathedral with the fly in the nucleus. So most of the atom is empty space. So anyway, that's Dr. Nagioka, who I always think looks like what Peter Ellis is going to look like when he's a little bit older. And Peter, I think you're online somewhere, so you can touch for yourself. How old is the universe? Well, the universe is 13.8 billion years old. And one of the fascinating things about astrophysics is the large numbers that they use. So Carl Sagan came up with a different plan and a different metaphor. And his metaphor was to compress the entire time period of the universe into one calendar year. So starting at the top left, January the 1st, we're down the bottom right, New Year's Eve, approaching midnight in one calendar year. So what I want to give is a sense of the scale of what man has achieved and when relative to the Big Bang, January 1st. So on the 31st of August, the sun is born. On September the 15th, the earth is born. Good. On December the 24th, the dinosaurs appear. And on December the 28th, they disappear as the first flower blooms. So today is New Year's Eve. And at 9:45 p.m., the hominids stand up for the first time. At 11 p.m., 1 hour ago, we make tools. And by the way, in this scale, each second is 500 years, and each minute is 30,000 years. So at 11 o'clock, we make tools. 15 minutes ago, the Neanderthals make their first appearance, and 12 minutes ago, we do. 14 minutes ago, we tame fire. 2 minutes ago, we start to talk. 40 seconds ago, the domestication of plants and animals appears. This is very important in medicine because the diseases that started to be recorded were very different. Infectious diseases became much more prevalent, and the osteology record shows that there were dietary diseases because the nature of the homogeneity of the diet once we started to live in communities. For our purposes, 20 seconds ago, writing begins. 10 seconds ago, we invent the wheel. 6 seconds ago, Moses is born. 5 seconds ago, the Buddha. 4 seconds ago, the Christ. 3 seconds ago, the prophet Messiah. And 1 second ago is Martin Luther, Prophet Muhammad. So our planet has three different orbits, if you like. There's a geosphere, which is the planet. There is the biosphere, which is the life on the planet. And there is the new sphere, which is the thought, which is what I want to explore this evening, the nature of thought. And as Teilhard de Chardin, the paleoarchaeologist, said, we are the animals who know, and we know that we know. So tonight's story begins just 20 seconds ago. And there are multiple writing systems appeared across the world. And unfortunately, there isn't time to talk about all of them because it's a shame because they are really beautiful things. For example, this is the Indian writing system, the Indus or Harappan script, which is 3.5 millennia BC, a very beautiful kind of images that were produced. This is the Hanzai writing system in China. Now, Chinese writing was back for about 6 millennia BC, but this is the first real cohesive writing system that has been evaluated. These are Mayan glyphs from Mesoamerica. They come a little bit later on. And they're very beautiful. They're also very complicated. They're red in pairs, and there are 80 of them. And they employ a mechanism called the Rebus principle, which I'll try and explain in a few minutes' time. This is Ogham script. This is Irish, our Irish version, which was 4th to 6th century CE, and it's read from the bottom and generally was used for naming. So, for example, on the right-hand side, you will see the name S-E-A-M-U-S, Dr. Michael Ear. So that's how you spell your name in Ogham script.
Not that old.
So where to begin? Well, as Gary Larson might say, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, but you've got to start somewhere. So I'm going to start in the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent was an area that stretched from Egypt through the Levant, Phoenicia, and into Mesopotamia. And Mesopotamia, by definition, is the land between the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, and two systems in particular that come within those, within that crescent. The first is hieroglyphs, and hieroglyph means the god's words. And hieroglyphs stretch back into the third millennium BC, and they were very mysterious. And what I want to show you is how they were deciphered. And they were deciphered using the Rosetta Stone. And the Rosetta Stone was discovered in Rashid, previously known as Rosetta, in 1799 by French soldiers. And there were three languages, hieroglyphs at the top, a strange language called Demotic script in the middle, and Greek at the bottom. And of course, the Greek could be understood. And the Greek was how they worked out what was on the rest of the stone, which was to do with the Ptolemy V, who was being, whose coronation was the reason for producing the stone. There were six cartouches on the stone, and these would be the clue. And what's a cartouche? Now, cartouche is the French word for a cartridge. And the soldiers that found these cartouches on the Rosetta Stone thought they looked like the cartridges. So there's a cartouche on the right-hand side image there, which actually was the cartouche that broke the code. This is it, inverted from right to left. And this is the word Ptolemy, which was the word that broke the code. And these are the three gentlemen that broke the code: Thomas Young, William Banks, and Jean-François Champollion. Thomas Young was described once as the last man who knew everything, an English doctor and polymath. Anyway, their insight was that the cartouches must include information, hieroglyphic information, that were, was important, about somebody important. And secondly, because Ptolemy wasn't Egyptian, he was foreign. So they figured that they couldn't, the ancient Egyptians couldn't have used pictograms to describe him. They must be logograms. It must be a language rather than a picture. And they were right. So here are the three languages. At the top, you have hieroglyphics, Demotic script in the middle, and then the Greek language at the bottom. And there's the word decoded, Ptolemaios. And from that, the decoding of hieroglyphs occurred. Moving to the other end of the fertile crescent is cuneiform script. And this was in Mesopotamia. And this was the ancient language of the Sumerians, which was then adopted by the Akkadians. And cuneiform script, I have a prop here. Cuneiform script was written on wedge-shaped stylus and clay tablets. I'm going to hand these around. So this, I'll explain what these are. Seamus, maybe you'd like to hand them out. Have a look. These are reproductions, but I really have them back. Thank you very much. There's five, it's a 5,000-year-old cuneiform tablet and a 4,000-year-old piece of hieroglyphics. Anyway, they were very often practical and commercial. So you can see that the one I've shown here is about the allocation of beer. So it was economics, really. And this is a picture, this is a proto cuneiform pictogram, slightly older than the one that you're going to see in a minute. And on the right-hand side is how they were actually produced with the stylus. Over the course of those 3,000 years, moving from left to right, you can see how each word changes its shape. So for example, star is a star shape at the beginning, but look at it at the end. When you get to the Assyrian level, it looks like a very elongated symbol with lines and dots in it. So it underwent a genealogy, as philosophers might say. Now, so this is John Martin, who many of you will know, I think. And so John was in ED consultants, but also an artistic genius. And he made the the two samples that are going around in a minute. And this is one that he made also. This is a cuneiform tablet that has been decoded and is in Cambridge. And that's what it says, top left, 18 jars of pig fat for Bali, 4 jars of pig fat for Namgir Abla. Fat was dispensed at the city of Zabala. The scribe was Ab Kikid, and it was made in the 4th year in the 10th month. You read them from left to right, by the way, and then down, then you flip it over from the bottom and read the other side. Who decoded it? Well, this is our first trip to Cork, a city that will form an important part of the story at various junctures. So the man that normally gets the credit for decoding cuneiform script is Henry Cresick Rawlinson, who had done a lot of work in Persia and had recorded cuneiforms. However, the clergyman on the left-hand side is the Reverend Edward Hinks of Killinay. He was born in Cork and is often depicted as a country parson, but he wasn't really. He had a distinguished family, went to Trinity College, won the gold medal in mathematics, and then accepted presumably a relatively quiet parish who could get on with his thinking. And what he was really interested in was hieroglyphs, but hieroglyphs had been solved by Champollion, so he moved his interest into cuneiforms, which he worked at in Killyleagh. But he spent a year at the British Museum, and he worked on the tablets that they have there. And after a year, he handed in his report. They kept all the work that he had done and handed it to Rawlinson, who then published on the etymology of cuneiform script. And when asked in old age how he had decoded them, Rawlinson said, "I can't really remember." So between these two gentlemen, cuneiform script was decoded. And cuneiform is a pictogram. So for example, a bushel of barley means a bushel of barley until you reach the rebus principle. And the rebus principle seems to have happened across the planet around about the same time. And the rebus principle comes from the Latin phrase non verbis sed rebus, not words, but things. And this is how it works. So here's a cuneiform, piece of cuneiform, and you can see on the left-hand side, barley. You can see it on the piece of cuneiform and also beside it. And also, hopefully you can see here, I would love to take these away, but maybe I can actually, no. Okay. This is the cuneiform pictogram for milk. So the Sumerian word, because I'm fluent in ancient Sumerian, the Sumerian word for barley is she, and the Sumerian word for milk is go. Okay, but when you put the two words together, she go, it means beautiful. Nothing to do with barley and nothing to do with milk. And that's the rebus principle. So another example might be, for example, belief in yourself. So the bee and the leaf make up belief, but they're nothing to do with either. This is the rebus principle. This is the beginning of literature. I found this one in my research. This is a very nice Victorian one. And if you can't read it, it says, "May I see you home, my dear." That's rebus. That's the rebus principle, beginning of literature. Now, of course, pictograms are very simple, and you wouldn't expect a complex society like ours to have anything to do with simple pictures, but there you go. The alphabet. Where does the alphabet come from? Well, you need to go to the Sinai Peninsula, to a place called Serabit El Kadim, the Standing Stones. And Serabit was a mine. It was ancient Egyptian mine, and they mined turquoise principally and copper. And middle picture there, these monuments are called stela, and the stela are hieroglyphic. Not very surprising, because it was ancient Egyptian. And they put up a stela every time they had a mining expedition. But in 1905, this little creature was discovered. This is known as the two-sided sphinx of Serabit. And the image on your left shows her right. And there are pictograms which are hieroglyphic. The picture on your right is her left. And if you look down at the bottom, I don't think I can I do this? I can, yeah. Just there, a mysterious language appeared. And this language was Canaanite. So the Canaanites were also in the Sinai Peninsula, also mining. And Egypt met Canaan, and a second language was discovered. The person that discovered the Sphinx and discovered the artifact you can see top left there was Sir Flinders Petrie in 1905, and it was decoded by Sir Alan Gardner. And the image on the right-hand side shows the alphabet. This is the Canaanite alphabet. And what I want to do is focus on one of those letters, which is the letter A. One of the Canaanite gods was Baal, who was a bull. And you can see on the right-hand side a picture of the bull, which was used as a letter in the Canaanite alphabet, fertility god. Also, you can see as you move down the image on the right-hand side, how with time it starts to change into something that's starting to look recognizably like an A. But see, the thing is, in the Canaanite language, only the first syllable of the letter is pronounced. So the bull, Baal, was actually pronounced Alepho in the Canaanite dialect. But the letter that they used to represent the bull, only the first syllable was pronounced, and that's A. The second letter of the Canaanite alphabet was Beth, so they pronounced it as a B. So here you can see, moving from my left to right, Egyptian, Sinai, Phoenician, rotates to the Greek Alpha, and then the Roman A. And it continues on, Aramaic, Nabataean, and Arabic. So I'm reliably informed this is the first letter of the Arabic alphabet, Alif. Looks like a hockey stick, but that hockey stick is actually a transmuted A, a bull. It's one of the Semitic alphabets. So on the right-hand side, what I want you to notice here is moving from modern Latin down to early Arabic, the letters at the bottom in the Semitic alphabet are cursive. What that means is they're curly and they join to each other. And that makes it easier for the scribes writing from right to left. And these cursive letters are common in the Semitic alphabets, whereas the Latin and Greek alphabet, you can see they're angular and they're separate. And that becomes very important later on because of what happens in about 1,000 years time. So most of the letters that we have in our alphabet come from Canaanite alphabet. R was the profile of a bearded man. O was his mouth and not Omicron. A was originally a bull's head, and D was a doorway. So that's where our alphabet comes from. Canaan, Phoenicia, Greek, Rome, Europe. Now, I got this the other day. It came from a very good friend of mine, sent it to me, Dr. Paul McCubry, and I think Paul's online, but he didn't know what I was talking about and didn't realize how much Carl Sagan was in this. Anyway, it's exactly what I was hoping to say. So Sagan said, what an astonishing thing a book is. It's a flat object made from a tree with flexible parts on which are imprinted lots of funny dark squiggles. But one glance at it and you're inside the mind of another person, maybe someone dead for thousands of years across the millennia. An author is speaking clearly and silently inside your head, directly to you. Writing is perhaps the greatest of human inventions, binding together people who never knew each other. Citizens of distant epochs, books that break the shackles of time. A book is proof that humans are capable of working magic. Carl Sagan. William Blake put it slightly differently. God and mysterious Sinai is awful to man's art gave. What pictures we use define us, all of humanity? If you wanted to have a series of pictures that would tell an alien species what we were like, how would you do it? What would you choose? Well, back to Carl Sagan. This is Voyager 1. And on Voyager 1, there were two plaques, the signs of Earth and the pictures. This is Pioneer 10. So on the Pioneer plaque, there's this. And this is how he summarized us. Moving from top to bottom, at the top, there's the hydrogen atom, the most populous atom in the universe. Moving around to the 2 o'clock position, you can see that the man has his hand extended. So which means we come in peace, plus we have opposable thumbs. Okay, down at the 3 o'clock position, there's a horizontal line that stretches right across the picture to the starburst on the left. And this is the distance of the center of the galaxy to our sun in a binary code. The binary code is based on the hydrogen spin flip frequency. So it's a time period. Down at the bottom, third rock from the sun tells any civilization that finds us where we came from. And then this starburst thing, these are 14 pulsars, whose time periods are known. And the idea was that an alien species would be able to figure out from these pulsars where we live, where our sun was. It's pretty good, but it was a bit contentious. It provoked some unexpected controversy. NASA's fight to protect aliens from naked ladies was one of the problems. People complained that the man and the woman were not clothed, which seems odd because it defies kind of scientific logic, but also that the man was accurately anatomically presented, whereas the lady wasn't. And that was decided by NASA. Speaking about nakedness and prudity, moving forward to the 16th century, this is a woodcut which was produced by Albrecht Dürer, Adam and Eve. And I want to show you this because it's code. So what I hope you can see, there are red boxes there, can you see? So I've put these red boxes around the parts that I think are the important part of the code. This is Dürer. So let's just fill this in. So the parrot, the noise of the parrot to a 16th century audience meant Hail Mary, the noise of the parrot. On the top left, the scapegoat is still on his hill, hasn't been banished yet. And then you have the four humours, the elk, the ox, the rabbit, and the cat. So the code here is that this is a moment of perfection before something was wrong in the Garden of Eden. And a contemporary audience in the 16th century would have understood the code, but there's no reason that we would understand that code because it's so long ago. And not knowing that is an error of perception. Now, it won't surprise you to know that if a radiologist spends less than 5 seconds looking at a chest x-ray, we'll miss stuff. However, there's a lot of evidence to show if we spend more than 60 seconds looking at something, we start to see patterns that just aren't there. And this phenomenon is known as pareidolia. My favorite is the elephant, where there's a definite face in the ear of the elephant, but you start to see these very strange patterns. Now, as a radiologist, I'm obliged to show you some radiology. So this is a chest x-ray, gentlemen. This is a chest x-ray, and there's a big lung tumor in this. But where is it? Now, as radiologists, we spend a long time looking at lines. What is that line? Why is that there? And this is a common area where we see interlocking lines and clavicles and ribs, but we're kind of going, what's that? That line shouldn't be, there must be an explanation. So what I tend to do with these sort of things is I, in the report, say an apical view is recommended for the patient's complete reassurance. So I'm telling the GP or the specialist, look, I reckon it's okay. Don't get them up to high, don't just tell them it's just him, he's just being careful. Except this time it wasn't overlapping shadows, it was a mass of the left apex. Very effective way of checking the apices just during the apical view. And here's the CT. Now, nobody in this room is going to miss that, but it was very difficult to see on the chest x-ray. Again, another friend of mine, this is one of the best papers that I ever read, written by Adrian Brady, the incoming European president. And I'm not just saying that because I commissioned it as editor of the Ulster Medical Journal. It actually is a brilliant paper on discrepancy and error, not just in radiology. So if you work in a branch of medicine where you feel that you could be accused of error or discrepancy, this is a paper that you should absolutely read. And I'm very happy to send on the information afterwards to anybody that would like to have it. Now, back to writing systems. So we've got three portable writing systems on the go now. You have papyrus, paper, and vellum. Papyrus comes from Egypt, made from vegetables, and it makes its way to Rome when the Romans invaded Egypt and took it over. Papyrus was dead cheap. A roll of papyrus in Rome would have been the daily salary of a soldier, one denarius. So it was pretty reasonable. Paper was also really cheap. It was a secret for 6 centuries in China. Nobody didn't tell anybody how they did it, but it was so cheap. 1,000 years ago, a Chinese citizen could buy a booklet which was blank. And the vellum, the Magna Carta vellum, is totally expensive. So as some observers have pointed out, this will reflect thinking. Because if you live in Egypt, Rome, or China, you can write your ideas down as you have them. Just write them down, you know? Whereas lots of ideas were lost in Europe because there was nowhere to write them down, because the vellum was so expensive. And nothing was wasted. Now, curiously enough, the secret of paper emerged in about the 7th century, 7th, 8th century, when China attempted a westward expansion, and they were stopped in Samarkand by the Persians. And in the entourage of the Chinese army, they find these blokes with paper and said, "What's that you've got there?" And they said, "Oh, we've got paper here. That's very interesting. We'll just take that." So the The Persians, the Uzbeks, and so forth started to make a lot of paper. And this is the golden era of Islamic science, when these polymaths started to write about science, about mathematics, geology, astronomy, and produce book after book after book, because they had access to paper, a cheap portable writing system where they could write it all down. Europe was lagging behind in medieval times. That was about to change. This is Johannes Gansflesch, John Gooseflesh, who was a serial inventor. And he just invented a thing. And the thing that he invented was a periscope. And the periscope, the idea of the periscope was you went to a religious event and you couldn't get to the near the front. So what you would do is put the periscope up, the grace would come down the periscope and you would capture it at the bottom. You would go home and enjoy the sanctification in the privacy of your own home. Now, this idea didn't fly very well, so he was on the run from his creditors, but he had another idea. And for this idea, he said, Gooseflesh isn't going to do it. So he changed his name to the street that he lived in, which was Gutenberg Street. And in 1448, he made the movable the printing press with movable type. And there was an explosion immediately. The first book that he produced was the Bible. So there was a big thumbs up from the church. He also produced plenary indulgences, and he was able to mass produce those and making a lot of money for the church. So with the imprimatur of the church, printing took off massively. Now, do you remember we talked a little bit earlier on about the shape of the letters, the modern Latin, Greek versus the letters of the Semitic alphabets? So this is where the problem started. His first book is the Bible. And actually, he used to have it colored in, so it looked like it was hand produced, but actually it was mass produced. So he worked a very good trick there. On the right hand side, you've got the Quran. Now, there were two problems with the Quran. First of all, for the faithful, it was the divine word of God as given to the prophet by the angel Gabriel. So it was intrinsically divine. So there were objections to a machine producing it. The second problem was the cursive nature of Arabic script. The words join from right to left. But with the printing press, they would be separate. And this would be unintelligible to someone reading Arabic. So for those two reasons, printing in Islamic countries slowed right down for 200 or 300 years. But in the West, it exploded. The Renaissance, ideas, thoughts, science, philosophy, all those things, all because of the nature of their letter and because of the availability of paper. I'm going to propose that the most important language ever created on the face of the earth was made here at 5 Grenville Place in Cork in the mid-19th century. This is the house, left-hand side, this was the house until quite recently where the language was created. But you can see on the right-hand side that it has been restored. And this is, you can see a little bridge here, I hope. There's a little bridge. I'm showing this for two reasons. First of all, to show how close it is to the Mercy University Hospital, which is where Adrian Brady works, and also to show you how inconvenient the hospital staff parking is across the river, which I thought was just, you know, the town changes, but the rules remain the same. So this was George Boole, who wasn't a philologist, he wasn't a linguist, he was a mathematician, he was a self-taught boy from Lincoln who became the first professor of mathematics in University College Cork. And his language was really unusual because there were only four things in it: true, false, one, zero. So with this language, every machine that we know, every wherever it is, my phone, my computer, everything else, is all speaking that language. This is the language of technology in the 20th and 21st century. He published it in 1854, The Laws of Thought. So moving ahead quickly, Alan Turing then has the imitation game and the Turing machine. Turing, as you know, took his own life by eating a poisoned apple. Claude Shannon is the father of information theory, and his ideas, big ideas, that a switch will follow these rules on, off, 1-0. Okay. Bottom left is William Shockley, Nobel laureate, who invents the transistor. And on bottom right is Gordon Moore. And Gordon Moore, with Robert Noyce, set up a company called Integrated Electronics, which we know as Intel. And they created integrated circuits and microprocessors. So it's speeding up. Thought is speeding up, and information is speeding up. He also propounded his famous law. Processor speeds, or overall processing power for computers, will double every 2 years. And they went to an unregarded part of California called Palo Alto. And this is it today. You'll be aware of the idea that chess was thought to be the apotheosis of human thought. So Boris Kasparov is beaten by Deep Blue. Then Watson, another IBM machine, is created and it defeats the Jeopardy. And you know, the American game show Jeopardy, the two winners were beaten by Watson. Very, very fast machines. And then at the bottom is AlphaGo, the ancient Chinese game of Go. So the number of the atoms in the universe is 10 to the power of 80. The number of possible chess moves is 10 to the power of 120, but the number of moves in Go is 10 to the power of 360. So these machines are getting really, really fast. But all that information is now available in a PlayStation 3. Warren Bennis said that the factory of the future would only have two employees, a human and a dog. The human will be there to feed the dog, and the dog will be there to keep the human from touching any of the equipment. It's very difficult to make predictions, said Yogi Berra, especially about the future, but I'd like to make one now. This is what I think is going to happen to medicine with artificial intelligence. It can be summarized in four words: numbers, pictures, gloves, and hunches. The closer you are to a number, the more easily what you do can be replicated by a computer. Some examples of routine medical tests, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing is, these are all numbers, and we can't compete with computers in terms of crunching numbers. So specialties that use these tend to be highly complicated and intellectually demanding specialties. Nephrology, for example. The computer will work much faster. As Noam Chomsky said, a computer winning chess is no more surprising than a forklift truck winning a weightlifting competition. It just works fast. We use pictures, and radiologists in the room will recognize this is a fillet, as we have to call it, fillet view of the colon. And what you have here is a 7 millimeter polyp, or rather the computer has colored it in for me and said, do you think that's a polyp? And I have to figure out, well, whether I agree or disagree. But these are digital images. So these images are all 1-0. So again, we're at the number end of this algorithm. Gloves. We always tell our registrars now to wear a pair of gloves. If you want to have a career, you've got to put gloves on. And let's look at the specialties: obstetrics, surgery, anesthetics, interventional cardiology, radiology, endoscopy. People wear gloves. It's very hard to replicate these skills with computing. There are robotic surgery machines, however, it's a bit like flying. We all like to have a pilot on the plane. Finally, we have hunches. The hunches, I would put it to you, as the highest order event. It's intuition. So every doctor in this room has gone into a patient's room or a ward at some point and thought, that lady is really sick. But the intern or the F1 or the S2 is saying, numbers are all fine, scans are normal, but you're still thinking, she's still sick. How do you know that? You know, because your mind is working on past experience, but also the idea that it's a non-linear, non-Boolean kind of thing that's happening. Very high order event that's very hard currently for an artificial intelligence to replicate. As an aside, with your phones, again, more symbols. The Bluetooth symbol on your phone. Bluetooth symbol on your phone is named for Harald Bluetooth, Harald Blåtand, who was a 10th century Viking king from Norway. And what he did was he united all of the tribes of Norway and Denmark. And Jim Kardesh of Intel / Nokia said they had this new system of short range, high frequency systems that would unite a phone with a computer, with your car, with your stereo. And they said, let's call it Bluetooth. That'll do until we get a better name for it. So they called it Bluetooth. And the symbol that's used for Bluetooth is what's called a bind rune, I beg your pardon, which are the two letters of his name, Harald Blåtand. So when you look at your phone next time, remember there's a 10th century Viking king. There's also a 9th century Uzbekistani mathematician called Al-Khwarizmi. And Al-Khwarizmi was a hugely important mathematician in the Golden Age. And he produced many books on mathematics, which the actual word is algebra. It's an Arabic word. And he was so prolific in mathematics that when his name was Latinized, he was known as Algorithmi. So the word algorithm comes from this man. So in your phone, there's a 10th century Viking king and a 9th century Uzbek mathematician. And you use your phone to access the internet. It's ubiquitous. The guy on the right is Michel Foucault. Michel Foucault was a French philosopher. He died in the 1980s of AIDS. And he had some very interesting ideas about the nature of education and the nature of society. And his view was, I'm summarizing here, his view was that it's coercive, that we are a passive recipient in a society and we're molded by the society. And I want to illustrate that using a Snickers and a Kit Kat, if I can. So let's say on the way home, you decide to get some petrol, call in at the garage and say, I think I'll have a Snickers, maybe I'll have a Kit Kat, not too sure. Foucault said two things. One, you won't steal that, you'll pay for it. And his philosophy is you won't not steal it because you're frightened to go to jail. You won't steal it because you're not that kind of person. You just don't do things like that. You walk in and steal a chocolate bar. You won't do that because society has made you that way, because all of the interactions that you've had for your entire life make you that way. Similarly, your decision to choose a Kit Kat over a Snickers is not random for him. Again, all those interactions have led you to that point, which on a Thursday evening in December decides you're going to buy a Snickers. Now, many philosophers disagree with many philosophers, that's for sure. But many philosophers disagree, but he's saying that the choice is made for you. What's more interesting in terms of ethics and morals, especially in medicine, is if you haven't got any choice, you haven't got free will, you can't sin, and you can't be immoral because it's all happened to you. Hey, so you don't have any responsibility. That becomes a very profound thought. And his other interesting idea was what Jeremy Bentham described as the panopticon. This is a panopticon. Crumlin Road Jail is a panopticon, and a panopticon was a jail. And the idea was that the warders in the jail can see everybody all the time. You can see you all the time. And even when they're not looking at you, you don't know they're not looking at you. So, you know, there you are. You're under observation all the time. And this was very much Foucault's view. Discipline, punishment, education, observation, molding. So how does the internet mold us? We need to think of another reverend gentleman, and this is the Reverend Thomas Bayes. And this is Bayes' theorem. Very complicated mathematics. I can't pretend to understand it, but luckily Bayes had a thought experiment to go with it. So here's the thought experiment. So Dr. McAleer is sitting there in a chair. Behind him on the chair is a table. And on the table, I place a red ball. So Seamus doesn't know where the red ball is, but he knows it's on the table. And then I take a yellow ball and I put the yellow ball beside the red ball, but I do tell him where the yellow ball is relative to him and relative to the red ball. And I do that again, and I do that again, and I do that again. And each time I'm giving Dr. McAleer more information, to the point where his knowledge of where the red ball is getting very significant, to the point where he knows exactly where the red ball is. The yellow balls are cookies and you're the red ball. So the idea of the internet is, as you interact with it, it's learning about you. We all know this. It's learning about you, and somebody somewhere knows everything about you. You're a commodity, and that's how the internet works. Centaurs, this is an AI term. A centaur is something that's half human and half machine, like a drone, for example, or your phone. And they're very interesting because the morals and ethics of thinking about centaurs are ours, because despite the fact that there's no pilot on that plane, whatever the drone does is a result of our interactions. So ethically, it becomes a very interesting issue. And then the super intelligent AI, this is Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Deep Thought, for whom IBM named Deep Blue as a tug of the forelock. A computer so powerful that even before its operational data banks were switched on, it had deduced the existence of income tax and rice pudding. So the question is, when humanity are building super intelligent AI, automata that you wind up and let go, once we've made them, they're off doing their own thing. How do we make sure that the morals and ethics within it are satisfactory. It's a very difficult area. And I just want to illustrate it with two different philosophical ideas. Immanuel Kant and Jeremy Bentham. So Kant is a deontologist and Jeremy Bentham is a consequentialist. What's that mean? What it means grossly for Kant is it's the intention is important. The honesty of the intention is important. You must never tell a lie. Okay. So if, for example, I said to Kant, do you think I'm a really good? Yeah. You think the shirt suits me? No. So you can see that's quite hurtful. His honesty was very hurtful because it was important that the intent was always transparent and was always honest. Jeremy Bentham is a consequentialist utilitarian, which you might say is whatever causes the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people is grand. That's a utilitarian argument. And you might think that's quite good. On the other hand, you might think that a large country which persecutes, let's say, theoretically, a group of people within the country because it doesn't approve of its religious practices, on the grounds that if it disposes of that particular group, then it will cause more happiness for more people. All of a sudden, it's not such a good idea, really, is it? Not that that would ever happen. Frank Drake is a 92-year-old astronomer, and Frank Drake produced the Drake equation. And the Drake equation was an attempt by him to work out how many planets in the galaxy had life. And he came up with a number between 1,000 and 1,000,000. And it led the great physicist Enrico Fermi to say, hey, where is everybody then? It's very silent out there. And one of the postulates is the great filter. And the great filter is that every civilization in the galaxy that created an AI brought about the means of their own destruction when the needs of the AI ran parallel and then stopped being of any interest to the needs of the civilization. Civilization was terminated. So we may be just simply one in a long number of civilizations who are producing the means of our own destruction. So what happens to us? This is very important, obviously, isn't it? Whatever we build is very likely to affect what happens to us next, because like everything else in the universe, an intelligent AI, like a piece of lichen, like a bird, wants to be, wants to live. And if it's living in a world where the dominant species, I mean, we're the first people ever, as far as we know, to have created another species. But if, you know, there are wars, famines, climate change, all the things in COP26 and everything else that takes away an AI's resources, needs those resources, so it may decide maybe it's time that humanity has a minder or something worse. So we need to look after it on the understanding that in due course it will do the same for us. Now, Moore's Law's flaw is that we make computers, and those computers then, as they get faster and faster, it takes about 18 months, 2 years for doubling speeds. But when computers start to make themselves, those times contract right to the point where there is no law. And this is the point of the singularity, where the laws break down. Everything's happening so fast. And I'm always reminded of the famous quotation between Nixon and Zhou Enlai in 1971, when Richard Nixon said to the Chinese deputy premier, what do you think of the consequences of the French Revolution? And Zhou Enlai said, it's too early to tell. Finally, on the 14th of February 1990, Voyager 1 was 6 billion kilometers from Earth. It was about to exit the solar system. And you can see where it is there. And after 10 years of persuasion, Carl Sagan persuaded NASA to turn it around so it could see Earth as it left the solar system. And Earth is very hard to see. On the right-hand side, you can see a picture of Earth, and it's called a pale blue dot. And if this plays, this is Carl Sagan, one of his last broadcasts, 2 minutes long, and it is his description of the pale blue dot.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, Everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering. Thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines. Every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the only home we've ever known. The pale blue dot.
The movie Finger writes, and having writ moves on. Nor all thy piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line. Nor all thy tears wash away a word of it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions from the audience? And that includes the audience at home. We can now unmute themselves and ask a question if they choose.
Is that why you retired from the AI?
Exactly. That's it. Couldn't compete.
Can I ask a question? Hugh McKenna here. Hugh McKenna here.
Yes, Hugh. Hello.
Barry, that was excellent. Excellent.
Thank you very much. Well done.
I'm an educationalist, as you know, and I was interested in what you talked about the choice between a Snickers bar and a Kit Kat and Foucault. And we look at Foucault as a very, very important person in education. I got the impression from you, well, actually, I didn't. I want to know, do you agree with that? I wasn't exactly clear how you felt about him and his philosophy.
One of the things I discovered doing the philosophy degree was that all philosophers disagree with all other philosophers, and it's part of the deal. It's a very interesting idea, I think, that, and it's a Nietzschean idea that Nietzsche was more, I suppose, perceived as malignant, and Foucault was more, you just have to understand that one has to understand rather that society molds one much more than one thinks. And that we aren't as free as we think we are. And many of the decisions that we make are passively imposed. So his education he calls biopower, and it's a positive thing. It's a positive thing, I can't see anything not to like about that. But behind it all, in my understanding, Hugh, behind it all is the idea that we are being molded, and the kind of education, no matter what it is, and this is education with a capital E in society and the world, whatever that one does, is being kind of molded. And that works, I think, from my perspective, very well within social media and the internet, where you are being told what to do. When I was writing my dissertation, right about the time was, you'll remember that there was a problem with Instagram, or I think it was with teenage girls. And the problem was that they had done internal research which showed that the impression that they were giving to some teenage girls about what they should look like was producing a lot of depression and anxiety and so forth, but they had concealed that. So I think that for me, there's a very interesting connection between Foucault and the internet, but I don't think he's malign. I think he was just warning that we are being more, if you like, we're the marionettes and there are strings that are pulled. Does that make sense?
Okay. I would have said that education was benign molding.
Okay, yeah, well, yes, yeah. Well,
indeed. That's why I believe I'm allowed to do it, because I'm helping people reach a better view of the world.
That's what education is always says, James.
Questions around? I want to ask you, how long have we got? Long before AI wipes us out. Should I spend all my money and borrow a lot more? Is it that soon, or is it 100 years away?
I would say don't buy any green bananas. That's the way I look at it. 2050 is a figure that is often bandied about in these kind of circles. A lot of commentators feel that machines will reach human level intelligence by 2050. And some before then, and that the jump from human level intelligence to super intelligence may be very, very short. And it's a lot of it, I suppose, it depends on us. And there's a big debate as to whether these machines are conscious or not. But then there's a big debate amongst philosophers about what does consciousness mean. And my long-suffering tutor, I think, is also online, said, don't write your dissertation on consciousness. It's just going to blow everybody. It's terrible. So one of the ways, for example, how do you know you're conscious? And one of the ways that philosophers tend to talk about this is a thing called qualia. So for example, if you imagine in your head a really red apple, nice juicy red apple, and you bite into it, you have an idea of what that's going to taste like, right? Okay, that's consciousness. But we don't really know what consciousness is, don't really know if computers are conscious. And the question I would put to you is, those of you who remember Pol Pot, Pol Pot would go around and say, right, who's educated, who's a teacher here? And then they put up their hand and they'd be killed. So the smarter people learn to keep very quiet. So my point is, if you were a super smart machine, someone said, oh, you're very smart. You go, no, not really. And just keep it to yourself. And that's in the benign civil world of AI. Who knows what's going on in military applications and so forth. So 2050 is the answer, James.
Okay. I think I'm safe enough there. Any other questions?
So are you hopeful for the future,
Barry? Well, I'm retired. Yes. No, I think so. Yes, I know I would be naturally an optimistic thing. But I think it's very important to think about these things, to think about it, what's coming up behind us. There's also a lovely philosophical story between Zeno's paradoxes. He was a 6th century BC philosopher, and he one of his stories is about Achilles and the tortoise. And so Achilles is the fastest bloke in Greece, and the tortoise comes up to him and says, challenge you to a race. And Achilles says, what, you're a tortoise? What? And he says, nevertheless, I'll challenge you to a race. Okay, says Achilles. One condition, says the tortoise, I need a 100-meter start. No problem, says Achilles. So tortoise takes off 100 meters, okay, and then Achilles goes for it. But with the paradox, when Achilles gets to 100 meters, the tortoise has moved on 10 meters. And by the time Achilles has moved the 10 meters, the tortoise has moved on 1 meter. The point is, you can never have a number and get zero. So therefore, Achilles can never overtake the tortoise. But of course, in real life, it goes right past. Very interesting paradox. And I think of that paradox in terms of AI, because many people believe that we are the most sentient species on the planet and always will be. But I think we're the tortoise, and AI coming up behind us will overtake us. Now, for many philosophers, they will say, no, that's impossible, because there's something unique about humanity. We have a unique consciousness and a uniqueness that is very special. Whereas I'm challenging that and saying, really, are we that unique? You know, we don't know what consciousness is. These things are pretty smart, you know, and they're starting to build themselves. So part of my interest is in how would you design a machine that you leave a little sort of seed in. And I think this is very much like the idea of original sin, right? So the original sin that spreads out amongst humanity. So a child is born, but it has original sin because it's part of the, you know, it's part of, in the Christian faith, it's part of the of humanity. And I think the same kind of thing happens with AI, that we built AIs, we built them at the start. So our code and imperfections are inside that. But I think it behoves us to think about how we set up a system inside an AI that is ethical and moral. But I would be hopeful for me.
There might be questions in the chat.
Chat. All right then, okay.
Barry, could... Can I make a Rob Jackson here?
Hi, Robbie.
Thank you most sincerely for the invitation to the lecture, which I found really fascinating. And I know that the man himself, Des White, would have found it equally, would have been delighted with the content and delighted to have the lecture in his honor. You were talking about the end of the world. In my youth, 1960 was the date. And on Christmas, or New Year's Eve, 1959, I think every household in the west of Ireland that could come for anyway, they were all looking out their doors, their back doors, to see what was going to happen next. Yeah. I don't want to hog the show, but I might be one of the last people to have worked with Desmond White and to have known him. So can I just give an anecdote, or do you have time?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I went to work in Alt McGelvin in the 80s, and Des used to come in at least one afternoon a week. And he believed in the four P's. And he said to me, this is what you do when you're working. You prepare, you have patience, you have persistence. And what was the other one? I actually wrote them down because I could never remember them. Oh yes, politeness. Now I could have added a fifth, procrastination, which was the one I believed in the most. But there was an anecdote. Des was a very fair and a wise man. And there was a junior doctor working in the hospital in the 60s who used to pay frequent visits to the nurse's home. And on one occasion, the leg of a bed came through the first floor ceiling. So the lady who was in charge of the nurse's home approached Desmond White, who was the wise man in the hospital, and said that something had to be done about this doctor. He had to be fired, he had to be suspended, and so on. I'm not sure whether she was more worried about the nurse's virtue or the ceiling, but anyway, Des called the man and admonished him. And he said that from now on, you should confine your activities to the ground floor of the nurse's home. That was a measure of Des White. He was fair and he was wise. And that houseman ended up working in my hometown in the West and still alive and well. So, Barry, thank you very much again.
Thank you very much, Robbie.
The invite and the fascinating lecture.
Thank you.
I understood some of it. And I'll talk to you about the rest of it when I see you, hopefully early in the new year.
Absolutely, Robbie. Thanks so much. Thanks. I'm just looking through the chat here, and there is a chat from my very long-suffering tutor, Dr. Carol Jones. I'm sure I drove her to distraction, but she's very patient. And she said, you mentioned the galloping and accelerating pace of machine intelligence approaching the singularity beyond which it will be racing out of our reach. And that's the point at which we might face our own destruction, as perhaps other civilizations did, but the internet and the algorithms that govern it and what we consume and see and do and even think seems to be governed not by intelligence, but by very fast stupidity. Trillions of tiny little banal computations usually made in the interest of a company's profits. Are we going to be destroyed by intelligence or just by very speedy stupidity? It's a very good point, actually, isn't it? Just a show of hands here. What do you think? Speedy stupidity or intelligence? Okay, so it's unanimous. Speedy stupidity. Thank you very much, Carol, for that. I'm just seeing what else. Dr. Brady has said Barry 01101011100. Very good. Let me see. Peter Ellis, hopefully I'm not being molded by society, but I'm using free will. Do you think that human intelligence and machine intelligence are the same thing? That's a very good question as well, isn't it, Bennett? See, the Wreath lectures are on at the minute, and the first Wreath lecture was yesterday, and there was a discussion about intelligence, and I'm trying to remember now what he's... So, for example, he said, Richard Kahn, there isn't a general intelligence, generally understood, I think, excuse me, general twice, that there isn't an entity that has the same intelligence that we have, in that you can do multiple things at the same time, that Deep Blue was able to play chess, but it wasn't able to do anything else. The internet can remember everything you've done, but has no intelligence whatsoever. So this seems to be one of the interesting things about various kinds of AI. They are intelligent, they are accomplished in particular ways, but what they lack is a general intelligence. So I would suspect, PK, that human intelligence and machine intelligence are not the same thing. Just looking to see if there's anything else here. I think that is probably it.
Any other questions from the audience before we finish?
Hello, Barry. Can I just ask a...
Carol, hello.
Hello, your long-suffering tutor here, Barry. Can I start by saying thank you very much for a fascinating lecture and congratulations again on achieving a merit in your philosophy MA. Very well deserved.
Thank you very much.
And I just wondered where you got that interesting picture of Kant, because we were looking at it and thinking he looked a bit like Charles Aznavour.
Yes, I got it from the internet. So it's probably not even real. But yeah, yes, Carol, that is a picture of, yes, I hadn't thought of Charles Aznavour actually, but yeah, it is, it's probably a picture that has been colorized, I think. But as far as I know, not that you can believe anything on the internet, especially about vaccines, that it is a picture of Immanuel Kant. But beyond that, I can't remember where I got it from. Did you like it?
Well, I was quite surprised by it. It doesn't look like the pictures I've got of Immanuel Kant. But
yeah. I love that he actually can't remember where I got it.
I didn't think of that. Yeah. Sorry, that's the best I could do, Carol.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll say thank you very much, Barry, for an excellent lecture.